Well, hey, whether you are enjoying a beautiful fall day with that hazy light and everything turning golden, or if you are cozy inside and it's raining outside, well, I'm Roxana, and either way, this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. We're on KGVM 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio. Welcome. So today I have another Desert Oracle Radio episode for you, and we're going to follow that up with a little bit of talk about bears and rattlesnakes and raptors and ghosts. Now it's time to have an audio look at the bulletin board of Ken Lane's mind in September of 2018. Let's see how he connects all the topics this time. We're going to listen to an episode of Desert Oracle Radio produced by Ken Lane on September 21st, 2018. It's called Lycanthropes of the West. Enjoy.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Tonight we are going to talk a little bit about skinwalkers. And one good way to talk about skinwalkers, whatever they are, is to think about the ancient mystical creature called the werebear. Sometimes it works like this. You fight and kill the bear. You eat the bear meat and then you put on the bear skin. The power of the bear shirt, Berserker in Old Norse, gives you the strength and fury of the great animal. This is what berserk means, bear shirt. Do you actually turn into a bear-human hybrid? Maybe. Nobody liked to go to war against the berserkers. That much is known from the stories of the Roman Empire's long northern border conflict with the barbarians, the foreigners, the champion Norse warriors, the ones who did not need chainmail. They fought without armor. They fought in a trance. They pile off those sinister Viking boats and slaughter everything in their path. The human-bear combination exists in North American and Siberian tribal religions, too. These stories go back to the bear sons, born to an animal god father and human mother. When the mother dies, the bear sons leave the human tribe and return to the bear people. The Navajo skinwalker is said to be something of this sort, at least sometimes. At least in some of the stories, it's a witch, a dark wizard, and through this dark magic, the witch takes the form of a four-legged beast, and then the beast does bad things. In the first werewolf movie, a two-reel film released in 1913, was called The Werewolf, and it was allegedly a Navajo skinwalker story. Screenplay by Ruth Ann Baldwin, based on an 1898 horror story by Henry Bogrand. The movie has been lost to history. All that's left is a still photo showing a gang of friars shouting the devil out of a barefoot girl with long black hair. Beorn, the werebear friend of Gandalf and the Hobbit, is of this lineage too. The same basic mythology is in the tale of Callisto and Arcas, the bear mother and son of ancient Greece, of Arcadia. Much later, American forestry managers accurately predicted most people did not know that wildfires are generally caused by lightning. Perhaps Americans could be trained to be extra careful with matches and cigarettes and combustion engines while out of doors, on public land, covered in trees that could be sold to make Dixie cups and Bounty paper towels. And so 1,000 billboards were put up featuring a humanized bear wearing blue jeans, but only its bear fur as a shirt, its bear shirt, telling Americans a lie about fire. Only you can prevent your own campfire from turning into a dry woods inferno. But the overall situation is somewhat beyond your individual control. Is the werebear real? Of course it's real. The second you or I or somebody imagines something, it is real. This is how magic works. People wear costumes at Halloween because they get magic power from wearing costumes and then become these other identities, if only for the night. If the California grizzly had not been hunted to extinction 100 years ago, you could go into the Sierra Nevada mountains or even the wetlands of Santa Monica and try to kill one of these majestic giants, wear its skin, and maybe become a werebear. But the would-be werebear would have a harder time of it today. The grizzlies are all dead throughout the continental United States, except for a northern range between the Cascades and the Rockies. Lewis and Clark claimed there were once 50,000 grizzlies between Hudson Bay and the West Coast. Los Osos on the Central California coast is named for the great wetlands filled with happy bears before the Europeans killed every grizzly in California, every last one. It's still on the California flag, at least. Now, wolves have come back with great human effort involved, the reverse of the great human effort it took to push the American wolf to the edge of extinction. And now that they're back, they are doing all right here and there. But coyotes have not only survived all barbaric human attempts to eradicate them, coyotes have also thrived. The coyote might be more compelling than the wolf, and more realistic in an urban or suburban setting. In our wounded world, the dire wolf vanished thousands of years ago. The regular wolf was nearly hunted to extinction in the past century, and coyotes are everywhere. They're in Chicago. They're in Central Park. A werewolf has two things going against it. It's a lycanthropic monster, and it's also a rare wolf. A were-coyote could pass almost unnoticed on the streets of any American or Canadian town. Nobody would run out for silver bullets. It's just a coyote. You can get more cats at the shelter. Maybe were-coyotes are wandering the dirt roads of Joshua Tree right now, wandering the Presidio lawns in San Francisco. The best human night of your life would not be half as exciting as a few hours of hunting rabbits in Golden Gate Park with your coyote friends. The werebear has few constraints other than the already depleted wild habitat of large brown bears. A full moon means nothing to this creature, nothing but better visibility on the bear trail. Silver bullets are also meaningless. religious symbols, the werebear honestly does not care. It's not against your religion, it's just not going to fall over dead because you have some holy water or a crucifix or a bracelet from the Kabbalah Center. The werebear's great weakness, like all bears, is its love of honey. A nickname for the bear in Old English was Bee Wolf, because of its insatiable love of honey. So Beowulf means the same thing, bear. In Russian, as well as many Slavic tongues, the word for bear is honey eater or medved. Bears also love fresh wild salmon, and that requires wild bear habitat. Free-flowing rivers, forests, oceans, clean water, no dams, no clear-cutting, no tar sands exploitation or outlet malls. Arctic werebears could use their rage against humanity, against the bad people who knew the North Pole would melt and decided they did not care. These people had accumulated enough billions of dollars like some brain-fogged dragon that they did not care what happened beyond the pile of money they nested upon. Imagine a dozen polar werebears bursting through the doors of ExxonMobil's stately headquarters, taking the executive elevator to the top and using their monstrous claws and teeth against the CEO and CTO and president of the board and all the rest of them. That would put climate change in the news. Now, there's outside counsel there working on site, and she sees it all. She actually buzzed the bears inside the executive suites. Her first name is Bernadetta, which means bear-like, and her law firm is very likely in cahoots with the lead werebear, Arctos, visiting from the Arctic, the Great Polar Desert. The word Arctic means near the bear because the North Pole seems to be near the constellation Ursa Major, the Great Bear, and Ursa Minor, the Little Bear, with its North Star. Arthur, Orson, Ursula, Bjorn, Osborne, these names also mean bear. Whether you aim to be a werebear or a werecoyote or simply the kind of person who does his or her best to maintain the wild habitat for these various animals and monsters, I hope it all works out. What I mean is, I hope you don't find yourself stuck in a place like Skinwalker Ranch. There's something alive that's part of this place, this haunted ranch, really just a ranchette, 480 acres, but good pasture, a creek through the property, lots of mature trees, mostly big cottonwoods. There are a couple of homestead cabins on the property. I guess you could call them fixer-uppers. They're in real bad shape, and they're also haunted, like everything on this ranch. In the middle 1990s, a family from New Mexico bought this small ranch up in northeastern Utah, tucked between a lot of tribal land, rural land. They were in the business of breeding cattle. If you like that cold Intermountain West kind of desert, you'd like it up there, but it's kind of dreary too. It's hard to explain. Well, the family fled the property after a couple of years. They kept seeing monster wolves roaming around, red-eyed beasts, shadowy human figures, strange craft moving across the sky. The ranch was purchased by a Las Vegas billionaire who studies UFOs and the paranormal. On the line, the documentary filmmaker and friend of the Desert Oracle, Jeremy Corbell. Jeremy, welcome back to Desert Oracle Radio.
Thanks, Ken. It's always an honor to be on. Excited to be with you.
Now, you have a new movie out. In fact, we started this show, Desert Oracle Radio, 1 year ago, and you also had a new movie out. But this is a different one. This is Hunt for the Skinwalker.
Wow, that's crazy. 1 year ago. Yes, this is a new film, Hunt for the Skinwalker. First time ever, people get to see footage from Skinwalker Ranch and both owners, previous and current, on camera interviewing for the first time. billionaire Robert Bigelow is on camera talking about the ranch. This is a first. It's also a first. The new owner goes on camera and talks about the ranch. We've never had a single piece of video footage come off the ranch. And you have hours of it, just hours of it now. And this breaks some news, man. This really breaks some news. You know, we all learned about a year ago that the United States government was studying the UFO phenomenon through the New York Times. We learned that last year. $22 million was spent to investigate so-called flying saucers. But the real story is much bigger. There was not just one UFO study, there were two. And the Pentagon's other larger investigation delved into these mysteries that are far more disturbing than alien spacecraft. And they focus in those studies on the living laboratory that we call Skinwalker Ranch. So this film breaks that news, man. That hasn't even been reported by Fox News, New York Times, anybody. This is actually through the Department of Defense as well. This is the mother program. It was called AWSAP. And what they did was they funded the Defense Intelligence Agency program.
So this second group that you're talking about...
It's a larger, it's kind of like a mother program. It's the dirty little secret. The United States government was not just studying a reactionary program called ATIP, you know, government-military interactions with UFOs. In fact, the host program, this one I'm talking about, AWSAP, was studying what we would call the paranormal. And yes, they funded it through the Defense Intelligence Agency. It's far beyond UFOs. There have been three major scientific studies at Skinwalker Ranch of what we would call the paranormal and UFOs. There have been three scientific studies. The first was the private industry study by Robert Bigelow called NIDS, National Institute for Discovery Science. After that, there was a study that was done by the Defense Intelligence Agency, funded through AWSAP, Advanced Aerospace Weapon System Applications Program. So now there's a third study under new ownership, private industry of the ranch. At least I'm going to say it's private industry. There may be further interest.
In watching Hunt for the Skinwalker, the viewer sees a lot of what looks like an earlier attempt at a TV documentary by George Knapp.
Yeah, George Knapp is the OG godfather of breaking stories like UFOs and the paranormal. He is a mainstream news journalist at KLAS who broke the Area 51 and the Bob Lazar story. He's also credited with like maybe 28 Emmys, Peabody Awards, multiples. I mean, the guy's a seasoned veteran in journalism. And he has been studying and documenting as the only journalist ever allowed on the ranch to document the progression of the studies for decades. Active, ongoing investigations while the events were unfolding at this ranch in Utah that had captured the imagination and interest of our Defense Intelligence Agency. Man, you want to film that. So that's what he was doing. He was collecting that footage, interviewing the scientists as events were unfolding. This can never happen again. It will never happen again. It can't. And that's what that footage is, woven into the fabric of current day events in my film, Hunt for the Skinwalker. But that footage could never come out. Now, in the wake of transition of ownership of the ranch, I was able to take that historic documentary vintage footage and integrate it into the new and current footage on the ranch that I have.
Your movie documents this frustrating attempt over many years to try to nail down whatever's happening at this kind of haunted ranch. Those guys were out there for years and years, and for whatever combination of reasons, they really don't have anything more than some stories.
What you're bringing up is something that I'm going to disagree with, but everybody brings it up, and I think it's important because that's the obvious, like, it appears that way because in one sense it's true. So you're saying there are scientists that were there for, let's say, the NIDS investigation for 7 years. Okay, what did they leave with? Obviously, science, as George says, science got its ass kicked, right? Obviously, they didn't get what they were looking for, and they were looking to either look for prosaic causes for what's been going on at this, you know, hell mouth, as you call it, of a ranch where, you know, everything from paranormal to poltergeist to UFOs occurs. But what factually, tangibly did science, was it able to determine? And a lot of people say, well, there isn't evidence. You know, they couldn't get any evidence. All they have is stories. I'm going to argue the absolute opposite. In fact, there is loads of evidence. First of all, do you figure that witness testimony from multiple witnesses that don't know each other from different angles of perception on one event, is that evidence? And I would argue, yes.
It is. But what's common is that groups of people can have these experiences and they're definitely real to the people who experience it, but there's nothing there that can be captured by a camera. Or when you do get something, you get light blobs, and then you talk to the people and they're, oh, you know, I saw a triangle ship and a being with red eyes. And,
right.
You know, so they're real, obviously. They took place. The events took place. But
there is an elusive nature, and we all have to come to terms with the intelligence that is there is probably an intelligence, and it is aware of our sophisticated electronic devices, that sort of thing. And if it doesn't want to expose itself, it has been able to not expose itself. However, there is physical evidence. Would you call a mutilated corpse, if it was a human body, you'd consider that physical evidence? Well, we have that. We've documented that. There's ice circle carvings that we know were done with tools. There is footage of stuff like the Twin Towers apparitions. But here's the big question, and this is where we get to a point where I think we're going to agree. Evidence of what? There is evidence, tons of it in the film, but evidence of what? And that's what I don't know.
Having been out there for that time, I'm talking about the original Bigelow team, the NIDS team.
143 incidents in a 7-year period. So not every night. You know, that leaves a bigger mystery. What was this thing that crawled out of an orange geometric inverted porthole witnessed by two physicists, you know, through night vision? What was that? But remember, there was a second study. So the next study that came in was the Defense Intelligence Study, where they allocated the money to BASS. That was the name of the group. What were they interested in? One of the things they were interested in is national security. How can you send craft through a porthole, through a rip in space, in the sky, and put that onto a battleground? They were interested in that. If they're witnessing that at the ranch, they want to know how to do that or deploy soldiers. Weird stuff.
In watching your movie and reading the book and following this for many years in the press, going back to that original Deseret News story in the 1990s, what occurs to me still is that Mrs. Sherman seems to be the key to the whole thing. Has she ever been brought back out there with these various investigative teams?
Absolutely wants nothing to do with the ranch, the property, the story, anything. They would not go on camera. They would not be interviewed modern day for the film. There's no interest. Remember, if this is real, it's terrifying. And that's what the sense that I get from the family that you mentioned.
Right. But for a long time, her husband, the rancher, he did work there with NIDS, both as kind of a caretaker and to try to point them in the direction where experiences had happened to his family, right?
He wanted to get to the bottom of it. He had his cattle mutilated, his dogs murdered. He was being run off his property, he thought at first, by the United States government. He wanted to figure out who was flying these ships and doing these kinds of strange things. Yes, he wanted answers. He was bold, strong, smart, well-educated, and tried to help the NIDS team hunt or stalk whatever this phenomenon is. Again, they were not successful. It followed them. There was a hitchhiker effect with the phenomenon itself, which I've heard over and over by DIA, by local authorities. It follows you. It followed him and his family through two states. It's corrosive. It seems to attach to you and slowly buries itself within you. It's very strange.
The encounters and the activity always went way up when she was there.
Well, there are people that seem to antagonize the phenomenon, but let's go a little bit broader. We need to really look at it this way. Skinwalker Ranch was a living laboratory, is a living laboratory used to study a much larger, global, enduring, historic phenomenon around since ancient times. So it is a great place to observe it. Is it only happening on the ranch? Is it invoked most by the old, you know, owner? No, not at all. The Uinta Basin is inundated with bizarre high strangeness. The phenomenon expresses itself, gives performances, in fact. all throughout the Uinta Basin and probably all throughout the world, but we're seeing it in a heightened state there in the Uinta Basin. And that's what this movie really engages, is this story of how our government studied the paranormal.
Tell me about the screening of Hunt for the Skinwalker.
We had a private screening in Las Vegas with some, you know, really kind of interesting guests that came in and got to see the movie for themselves, people involved, in fact, with the story.
Now, I heard that one of the people in the New York Times UFO study group story last year, Lou Elizondo, the head or the former head of this Pentagon UFO study group, was that at your movie?
I heard that as well.
How do you like it?
I can't comment on that any further. I shouldn't comment on that any further. But yeah, it was look, really interesting people were in the crowd that night, and people that were involved with this story on multiple levels.
Was Robert Bigelow there?
Again, you know, it was a private screening.
So Hunt for the Skinwalker has been out on iTunes for the past week plus now. What does it do next?
We were number one top documentary on iTunes, and then it was hovering between number one and four for days. We really hit a nerve, man. That's kind of what I'm noticing.
In Hunt for the Skinwalker, the book ends with a request for information on similar places around the world, because it's not just something that happens on this 480-acre ranch. It's a phenomenon that shows up in different places around the world. Now, I know NIDS at one point was looking for other properties like this to study.
Yes, there were other locations. You know, I say properties, I'm not sure. Locations, absolutely. Other locations identified both by the Defense Intelligence Agency as well as by private industry in these studies. Yeah, the book really opened the gates there. And there are other places like this, other pockets in the world where they say, you know, the veil is thin.
Intended to have something on tonight's program about the mysterious sudden closure of the National Solar Observatory in Sunspot, New Mexico. And it all got so dumb so quickly that once again an apparent mystery dissolves into an acid of ugly nonsense. Maybe something happened up there in the mountains. People are sure acting extra weird about it all. People including the FBI agents who were on site, the military pilots flying Black Hawk helicopters around the observatory and visitor center, the management of the observatory, the director of the observatory, everybody acting very weird in ways that make no sense at all. The sheriff agrees, the sheriff's department was shut out of the whole situation, and now, finally, a patsy. A groundskeeper living in a trailer on site has his name dumped into the sewage pond of life-changing accusations, but with no charges, no arrest. What a garbage world we live in, the world of modern people. Lots of potential with our species. Lots of potential and very little use of it. We should be as gods, and what do we spend our time doing? What do we spend our thoughts and energy upon most of the time, even people graced with the opportunity to do good and important work? Nonsense and garbage, junk mail, the garbage cell phone that rings all day from faked phone numbers, scams and threats read by a computer. Scumbags and liars, every institution soiled and stinking. The widowhood of every government signs for all to see. There are indeed places and seasons when and where the veil is thin, the veil between worlds, between our flesh and blood and garbage world and that one we have either imagined into existing on the other side or that may truly exist independent of our longings, our dreams. But that veil becomes as solid as a concrete wall when we market it, when we try to prove it, when we claim to understand it. You have been listening to Desert Oracle Radio. Good night. from the Voice of the Desert.
And you are listening to KGBM 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, and this is still Desert Oracle Radio Replay. I think maybe those berserkers kind of gave a bad vibe to grizzly bears. Do you? Well, I thought I'd look up a little bit from a book about bears and read it to you today. This book is The Behavior of North American Mammals by Mark Elbrook and Kurt Reinhardt. And I'm reading to you about the brown bear, Ursus arctos. Other names are grizzly bear, Kodiak bear, and silvertip. So the Lewis and Clark expeditions encountered and killed many brown bears, and they wrote about them with great trepidation. They sent their specimens to George Ord, who, without having ever seen a living brown bear, gave them the name Ursus horribilis to reflect their rumored savagery and brutal nature. Indigenous people throughout the West also respectfully feared the strength and power of brown bears. Foraging Tuchoni women in the Yukon never called bears by their name so as not to draw their attention, and they respectfully walked around bear defecations so as not to insult them. Many tribes refused to hunt bears or did so only under special circumstances. Athabascan hunters quickly poked out the eyes of bears they killed so that the bear wouldn't know who'd committed the hunt and come back to exact revenge. The bears encountered by Lewis and Clark were called grizzly bears, and they were considered a species distinct from the brown bears of Europe and other parts of the world. Today, all brown bears are classified as a single species and certain regional populations as subspecies. The grizzly bear of the Rocky Mountains is now called brown bear Ursus arctos horribilis. We talked about black bears last week being in hyperphagia, and those grizzlies are in hyperphagia right now too. And both species, when they are so intent on finding food to fatten up for winter, they're going to be even easier to surprise, and you don't want to do that. So be careful out there. If you're hunting, be sure you are staying clear of any carcasses. Know your bear signs. If you don't already, go to some expert sources and find out what the signs of the bears are, and stay away from those areas. Let those bears survive another year. And changing the topic just a little bit, here comes an episode of Field Notes.
It's time for Field Notes, brought to you by the Montana Natural History Center. My husband is an herpetophile. He's been snake crazy ever since he was a kid, as he's often fond of saying. While I'm not particularly phobic about them, I never had much experience with snakes of any kind until we moved to Montana, and I'm sure I harbor many misconceptions about their habits. This past summer, we spent a lot of time in eastern Montana, fishing and camping in the foothills of the Rocky Mountains, prime rattlesnake country. One morning, as I was shaking out a ground cloth in preparation for setting up our tent, a distinct buzzing sound, not that loud but definitely unlike the sound of wind through the grass or any insect or bird, stopped me cold. I'm not sure I'd even ever heard a rattlesnake in the flesh before, but my body knew it before my brain did. I looked carefully, but I didn't see anything. I waited, but heard nothing more. I thought perhaps I'd been mistaken, so I continued with the tent. Within a minute, another buzz, this time a little more insistent, and this time I did see the cause, a 5 or 6 foot prairie rattlesnake moving unhurriedly off, not too concerned, just giving me notice. His brown and greenish coloration perfectly matched the surrounding dirt and grass. He was probably on a morning route between the river and a nearby hillside of exposed sandstone and shrubs. We watched him go, and for the remainder of our time there we did not cross paths again, to our mutual relief, I'm sure. Starting in October, prairie rattlesnakes congregate in dens, piling into cracks and crevices in rock walls that may have served the same overwintering purpose for thousands of years. In May, they emerge from total darkness and spend a few weeks warming up and resetting their biological clocks, orienting to the sun before setting off on their separate ways in search of food and mates. A snake might migrate many miles from its hibernating place, moving in a straight line, continually testing for the presence of prey by using the sensitive organs on the roof of its mouth. Once snakes have reached a place where the concentration of prey appears adequate, they remain, searching out ground squirrels, deer mice, rabbits, and other groceries. These summer feeding grounds may also be staging areas from which snakes make forays to find a mate, sometimes a tricky proposition for the males, since in any year only half the female population is available to mate. The other half are pregnant and have remained in rookeries near their hibernating place to give birth to live young in late August and September. Females can also store sperm and so don't necessarily need to breed every year in order to produce offspring, making it that much tougher on the males. Come autumn, not long after the young of the year are born, the adults begin to return to their time-tested dens, ensuring their survival for another spring. It appears that communal hibernation and birthing aggregations are unique to snakes living in extreme climates, and that it is behavior evolved to cope with harsh conditions. I'm Caroline Kurtz for Field Notes, brought to you by the Montana Natural History Center, providing natural history education for schools and the public throughout Montana. If you have an observation of the natural world that you'd like to share on the radio, contact the Nature Center for information on writing a field note of your own. Call 327-0405 to find out more, or visit us on the web at www.montananaturalist.org.
And now for a word from a Cooper's hawk. Well, Raptor Fest is coming up October 7th and 8th, and I hope you can make it out there. It's all at Bridger Bowl. It's free, very informative, and lots of fun for all ages. Try to make it out there if you can. Here's a little bit more about raptors from Steve Hoffman.
The sharpton is the most likely of the three to visit your bird feeder. Anybody had a sharpton at their bird feeders? Yeah, especially in the winter. So the sharpton, again, small head, and the tail tends to be very squared off at the tip, okay? And the tail is proportionally not as long as what we see in the Cooper's hawk, or the goshawk, actually. Flying mallet, very small head. The young birds are heavily streaked breast and belly, pretty evenly streaked. The Cooper's, this bird has a full crop right here. Mm-hmm. See, when raptors eat, they don't know when or where they're gonna get their next meal, so they gorge. They fill up their stomach and they keep eating and they fill up their esophagus. It's like a little pouch of food in their throat. And as they digest the food in their stomach, the food in their throat goes down and gets digested too. But you can see birds. We might see birds tomorrow. There was a bird that we saw yesterday that, it had a red tail with a big bulge in its throat. And that just eaten. It had just eaten the meal. And over a period of hours, it will eventually digest all that and put on some fat. And you won't see that bulge, like a softball in its throat. Did you see that there? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is the flying crust. It's got a bigger, more protruding head and longer tail. And in the Cooper's, there's heavier streaking in the breast and lighter in the belly. I mean, you can see the whole breast and belly are streaked, but the belly streaking can be pretty faint. In fact, a lot of times it's not as much as this. And the chest, though, is often very heavy. So it's called a hangman's hood. because it looks like a hangman's hood because it's so dark in the chest and much lighter in the belly. Whereas the sharp chin is heavily streaked both breast and belly in the juvenile. Adult, they both have red barring under in the wing lining and on the breast and the belly. And they both have completely white undertail coverts and heavily banded tails. And the Cooper's has this distinct white band on top of the tail. You cannot see this from up looking up at the bird, but if you're looking down on the tail, and this bird has an obvious white band on it, and look how rounded the tail is. See how rounded it is? The central tail feathers are longer than the outer tail feathers. That's a Cooper's. The white tail band tip and the rounded tail make it a Cooper's. And the tail is super long. It looks like super long. Now the sharp chin has a very rounded head, small head. The Cooper's has more of a rectangular head. And the eye is more forward in the head on the Cooper's. The eye on the sharp chin is more in the center of the head. See that? But adult male coops have a lighter nape. Coopers and female coopers, they have it, but to a lesser extent. And sharp chins don't have it at all. The crown and the nape are the same color on a sharp chin. On a goshawk, the crown and the nape are the same color. On a cooper's, particularly the male, the crown is very dark on top, but it's set off by a lighter nape. And if you're looking down on a cooper's flying by, and you see that, you know that's a cooper's hawk. Okay? Now also, you saw that distinct white tail tip on the cooper's. Look at this on the sharp chin. It's what I call just a dirty white tip. You can't really see a distinct white band, can you? It hardly even shows up at all. It's so faint. And look how skinny those sharp chin legs are. So, and they eat almost nothing but songbirds. Sparrows, warblers, nuthatches. I once saw a sharp chin grab a chickadee right over my head once in the woods. I'll never forget that. It just came zipping in there and snagged it. And the chickadee was looking at me, so I was distracting the chickadee, so it didn't see the sharp chin coming. So it's all my fault. Okay, the great ghost of the forest, look how grayish the wing lining is, the chest, the belly, and this black mask coming out behind the eye, and you can't see this very well, but it's got a white line above the eye. And the white undertail coverts right here. But the juvenile goshawk has streaking all the way down to the undertail coverts. So the undertail coverts are not white in the juvenile, they're whiter. Then not, but they've got these dark streaks that darken up the undertail coverts a bit. And the streaking is heavier than a Sharpie or a Cooper's, all the way down to the belly. And it's also heavily modeled in the wing lining. But I don't know if you noticed this, but this goshawk, look at the wing shape. Isn't it a little bit falcon-like? And you can see that when it's flying. It looks a little, the wing is more tapered than in a Cooper's or a sharp chin. And it almost makes you want to call it a falcon, but it's not. It's just a goshawk. And they are one of the rarest birds we see up there, and the numbers keep declining. I could have shown you a graph, but it's bad. Mm-hmm. They're, I mean, between forest fires, bark beetles, drought, and logging, they don't have any forest anymore. So they don't have any breeding grounds. So we're not seeing goshawks much at all anymore. It's been a big change in the last 25 years.
Now I've got a little more of some samples of the ghost walk I went on a couple weeks ago. First, I'm going to play a little bit of an interview with one of the members of the Bozeman Paranormal Society, Shauna.
So there's a time when, like, before I knew about paranormal, I was pregnant with my daughter at the time. Mm-hmm. I never believed in this stuff. Never. And then all of a sudden, I, like, trying to go to sleep. I still have my eyes closed. You know, I'm not fully asleep. Mm-hmm. But then I hear a little girl laughing in my bedroom. Like, we had no little girls in the house, none whatsoever. We only had little boys, my nephews. And I wake up. and she's standing at the end of my bed in a pink dress with long brown hair, waving at me. And I'm like, what in the world is going on? So, and then within a second, she disappears. And I'm like, babe, did you see that?
Did you ever find out who she was?
No, because I didn't want to do stuff like that with my nephews in the house, you know. But now it's like the house that we moved out of a year ago, like yesterday, a year ago, it was pretty crazy because after my stepmom died, you know, I wanted to get a hold of her, you know, because I miss her so much. I'm still grieving over her death because it's been almost 2 years. But all of a sudden, I'm cleaning my dad's bathroom because I'm trying to make money to go to Colorado because that's where we went last year. We took a trip. And all of a sudden, the water turns on by itself. And after that, I'm like, what in the world is going on? Is it my stepmom or is it my brother? You know, and then after that, I walked out of the bathroom and in the corner of my parents' bedroom, I heard a woman say hello. And then I'm like, I started tearing up because I knew right then and there that was my stepmom. And I felt like something touched my right side. And I'm like, I kind of back it up. But I was like, okay, gotta, like, you know, I gotta, like, calm myself because I know that was my stepmom letting me know that she is there with me.
Nice. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Last week, I played a few excerpts from our ghost walk, and I hope you enjoyed those. I'm going to continue this week with a few stops right along Main Street.
This is the Bozeman Hotel. It was built in the 1889, and it has definitely the three floors, and it is now no longer a hotel, and it boasts several different businesses that are private upstairs. And up in the third floor, there used to also be a doctor's office as well, and lots of procedures. There's also been murders and suicides in this building as well. So, the fun thing is the ghosts in this building are mostly on the third floor, but sometimes you'll get the EMF meter to go off in the weird corners of this building.
Like what,
here? Yep, that has never gone off the last couple tours. For some reason, kids and this tour, they seem, if I only have adults during this tour, no EMF meters will go off. Only when kids are on my tour.
See, this is where I'm
worried. Yeah, I would be right here.
I can't tell if it's my EMF. It keeps changing when I
put it in. Oh, weird. And no, it shouldn't be because I've been charging it for 2 days.
Yeah.
And then also, on the third floor, they had lights turning on and off, seeing shadow figures. I had to attend this tour. And fun fact is, they own a printing shop on the third floor, and they would close up for the night to come back. So the printer's completely turned on again. So, just weird things. And like I said, the EMF meters sometimes go off, and sometimes, like, the dowsing rods are kind of weird in this building. I'll let you guys kind of at least investigate this part. Don't, like, wander that direction too much. Maybe stay. You can kind of go up to the stairs right there, so. But I think they found the ghost already.
Yeah,
so,
oh, dang it, just
yeah.
It glitched again.
It's
when
I'm standing right there, something grabbed my hoodie.
Oh,
weird.
That's why I'm over here now. I'm like, nope.
Nope, not today.
Because, you know, there was a wide opening, and I'm, like, standing where Elise is, yeah. And all of a sudden,
here, I'll
demonstrate.
Weird.
Huh? Bozeman used to have tunnels that led all the way up to the Wilson School, all the way down here. And they were used for the Prohibition era and also the opium dens and business use as well. This building here used to have a streetcar business that operated until the 1920s. And unfortunately, during a heavy snowfall and cars becoming more popular, they did have to close it down. Why I mention that is because there is a tunnel entrance underneath the Eagles. They now just kind of use it for storage now, and most of it has been caved off now as well. Why I also mention it is because when we guys were crossing the street, it also goes through the Bozeman Creek as well. And there's been several people that have actually drowned in the Bozeman Creek. And we assume that the energy is from that is why this place is so active. It's so spooky.
Where's
so,
the Bozeman Creek?
It says you did it when you go over
the
here.
One that
yeah.
Goes down the side of
yeah.
It. Okay. Sorry.
So no worries. No. So and there especially there was two ladies that did die and they did fall into the creek, and apparently that's why we assume that's why there's so much paranormal activity is because of all the tunnel systems and the creek flowing through the Bozeman area. The building over here is the Eagles Bar, and it was built in 1968. It was for several different entertainers to come out and entertain. Up in the second floor, they have had pretty much an entity pushing them out of the way while there has been a concert or something going on. They've also had dinnerware also fly off the shelves as well. So,
okay.
I was doing a tour one day, and we were walking with a group that was here for a school reunion, right? And we were walking past here, and this lady was holding me in that meter. And all of a sudden, she's like, it started to go off right here. So she said, can we stop here for a reason? And she told me it's because when she was a teenager, this is a girl, lady was like older, like an older gal. And she goes, there's a story behind this place. When I used to work here when I was 16, my boss at the time ended up dying from a freak accident in Billings and was jumping out of an airplane and his parachute didn't deploy. So, and all of a sudden, like, the EMF meter went off right here for when she was thinking of him. And I thought that was kind of weird. And when it spikes to red, I'm kind of weirded out by that, actually. So, anyways, then I took a tour and I decided I was just going to start skipping this part because we were, like, a group of 20. And I wasn't going to just stop here just because we're a group of 20 and whatnot. But I ended up having to because this one gal, when I have too many people, I have to encourage them to use apps and stuff just because it's just so much. And she had an app on here on her phone. And we had to stop here because it said accident. And I was like, that's really weird. And then it started to list off the summer months. And that's when he died. And then we decided to just kind of, like, do a session here. It was, like, maybe 5 minutes because it's just such a large group. It's not even funny. But, anyways, I always like to talk to him here. I'll do the I'll show you guys my dowsing rod. I end up just... They just work... I don't know about me anymore. So, anyways, is there a man here?
Oh, there's...
And can you point to yourself? I'm not even gonna look.
That one.
Because it's been standing next to the kids all the time.
Right here?
I know, I have a feeling. Are you happy I brought you kids?
Yeah.
And he was only 18 years old.
Aww.
So he was a very old guy. So
sad.
Very sad. And are you glad that I brought you some people to visit?
Were you lonely when you didn't have people?
Yeah, you know.
Yes. Can you cross and tell these people hello?
Hi.
It's pretty freaky.
Except me. Wow! What's that man?
Look at that picture. Joshua's the expert ghost
looks like
picture.
Oh, wow.
Look at that.
Oh my.
Wow. Like right here.
Nice.
How
I
did
told Katie to be pointed up there.
Yeah, there's a that. Does the rain help you communicate?
Yes. Wow, like a sperm.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. Are you running between me and Elise?
Whoa.
Us? This one's working.
See, they're standing by the kids. Did you not see that?
Right there.
Here. Wow. Where are you guys?
Still over near us. This one was going red for a second too.
Yeah.
And it's the broken.
Can you spike both of those objects for us to red? That
this
these kids are
yellow. Yellow's like the highest.
This one goes to yellow too. So,
three. Maybe one's checking.
Keep trying to go to red. There you go. Go to red.
It keeps going
is
up.
This one, like,
there go. There you go. You're trying to spike the other one. I saw that.
Like this one.
I saw it for a minute. There it goes a little bit.
Isaac's works. This one.
It's glitched. I can't see anything because it's glitching again.
Yeah. Oh, see, that one went back up to yellow again. Yellow is like the highest.
You
this
don't
one goes on
keep
the
trigger depressed. It doesn't.
Oh, look. It stops a little bit there. Can you tell these people see you later by spiking both of those boxes up to red or even as best
yellow.
As you can?
Yeah, yellow.
Okay. Oh, red. It hit red.
Yeah, this one's
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, thank you, Gallatin Valley, for listening. As always, you can call or text me and leave a message about anything on your mind. Let me know if you want me to call you back. The number you should call is 406-404-6246. Remember to spread the word that you can hear this program on the air at 95.9 FM Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgvm.org at 7 p.m. Sunday and 9 a.m. Monday. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are also available on demand on the kgvm.org website. So that's it for today. So till next time, listeners, be safe. Stay well and sweet dreams. Zoe Keating is taking us out today with Escape Artist from her album Into the Trees.